Good evening and welcome to Alaska Public Broadcasting's 2010 Debate for the State for Alaska's Governor. I'm Libby Casey. This is the last statewide gubernatorial debate before Tuesday's general election. Our program tonight is a joint production of the four Alaska Public Television stations and the Alaska Public Radio Network. We're coming to you live from KAKM in Anchorage. Gubernatorial candidates who've registered at least 5% in recent polls were invited to attend. While Sean Parnell is the Republican incumbent, he's running for his first election for the office. Elected as lieutenant governor in 2006, he became governor when Sarah Palin resigned last year. Democrat Ethan Berkowitz is a former minority leader in the Alaska House of Representatives, where he represented Anchorage for 10 years. Our panelists tonight are Dermot Cole, columnist for the Fairbanks Daily News Miner, and Dave Donaldson, Capitol correspondent for the Alaska Public Radio Network. Later in the program, APRN's Lori Townsend will join us. We've also gotten questions from Alaskans. Ellen will include some of them also this evening. Our thanks to the studio audience for being here tonight. Please remember to remain silent throughout the entire broadcast. Candidates' answers will be timed during the debate. You'll see a yellow light when there are 15 seconds left, and you'll hear this bell when the time is up. I'll try to enforce this as politely as possible so we can keep things moving and hear as much from you as we can this evening. Now let's begin. Our first question comes from Dave Donaldson, and candidates, you have 45 seconds to respond.
Governor Parnell, when you took over the job from Sarah Palin, you basically had kept the same administration and policies in place. What would be different under a Parnell administration if you are elected to the job for a full term?
Good question, Dave. You know, when we lose a governor midstream like that, that's an incredibly destabilizing moment, typically. And I said that at that time, my goal was not to be different, it was to be who I am. And so you saw me pursue economic growth policies related to lower taxes and incentivizing investment here. You saw me pursue opportunities for our families, like the Alaska Performance Scholarship and a comprehensive initiative on domestic violence and sexual assault. So you saw me, and Alaskans saw me, pursuing jobs and families type agenda on my own.
Mr. Berkowitz, do you think that a Parnell administration would be any different? Would you see a difference between that and the Palin administration?
Well, I think what's going to be different is a Berkowitz administration, because in a Berkowitz administration, you're going to have an all-Alaskan team. I mean, I'm pleased that already Bill Walker has agreed to join my team. He finished second in the Republican primary. I'm going to reach out to other Republicans, to independents. What I want is a team of people who are going to solve problems. I don't want a team that's content with the status quo, because if we continue to do the same things that we've done, if we continue to follow the same policies, we're going to wind up in the same economic straits that we face today.
Okay. Mr. Berkowitz, your elected career during the legislature was entirely in the minority, member of the minority. Can you point to some of your ideas that have come to fruition?
Sure. I was the first person to propose a statewide energy plan, and that's matured substantially since then. There's actually been details that have been added onto it. I was one of the first legislators to talk about a renewable energy portfolio for the state, and that's been adopted since I left the legislature. I had a pretty big hand in some of the ethics legislation. In fact, Sarah Palin asked me to co-author a white paper for her. So there's a lot of things that I did in the legislature that moved on. But I was also proud to be part of a body where people got along well together and we got things done.
All right. Governor Parnell, when you were in the state Senate, Republicans were in control. In the past few years, a bipartisan majority coalition has been in control. What I'd like to know is, would you have joined this bipartisan coalition if you were still in the Senate, or would you have been part of the Republican minority?
Well, when I was in the state Senate, I was in the Republican majority, but I was Senate Finance co-chair at a time when oil was at $9 a barrel. At that time, I had to get a three-quarters vote for the budget. That meant reaching across the aisle to get Democrats as well as Republicans together on a budget. I did it in a way that we reduced spending in that time. We didn't reach for the income tax, as my opponent, Ethan Berkowitz, has. In this case, in this time, I would stay with the Republicans who want to lower spending, decrease taxes, and increase jobs through investment here.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you.
All right. You know, I was reflecting on the answers you gave to Dave's first question about what would be different, and I don't think I necessarily have a sense of it yet. You mentioned your goals, what you'd really do, but can you name any agenda items that would be off the bat? This is my table now. This is my administration. What am I going to do differently here?
Well, listen, I said my job was not to be different. It's to be who I am. And I pursued a legislative agenda that dropped taxes, that increased opportunities for investment, that cleared paths for people to get a better education with the Alaska Performance Scholarships, and that freed women and children to come out of really sick situations with domestic violence and sexual assault and move out of those into freedom. So it's a difference in style and a different emphasis and agenda.
Okay, Mr. Berkowitz, any more specifics about what you'd want to tackle right off the bat?
Absolutely. Well, we needed some bold leadership out of Juneau, and particularly we've got to address the problem of declining oil production, and I've got some proposals to do that. We've also got to do things that are related to reducing the cost of energy across rural Alaska. But during the course of this campaign, I've offered a five-part, what I call Alaskan ownership stake, that would give Alaskans the ability to own a piece of the pipe, both as individuals and as businesses or corporations. I've suggested that Alaskans can do what's done in 27 other states and get lifetime hunting and fishing licenses. I've talked about the need for us to reduce our corporate income tax, to have a more independent attorney general, and to have more accountability in the governor's office. All of this would be done and more.
The Tea Party movement is in the news a lot right now. We're seeing activism here in Alaska. One of the goals of the Loose movement is to see a lot of the federal programs move to the statewide level, loosen federal control, including maybe even Social Security. What do you make, Governor Parnell, of the Tea Party movement and some of those goals? Is it realistic for the state to take on something like managing Social Security?
Well, on that particular issue, I think the Tea Party is blessed to be promoting freedom. I mean, that's who we are as Americans. That's what I want to represent as Alaska's governor. And so when you say, should the state be taken over more from the federal government, the answer is yes. The answer is when the federal government wants to impose national education standards on the state of Alaska, known as Common Core standards, I stood up and said, no, our local districts, our state will set those standards. The federal government is now trying to tie federal money to a philosophy that we don't buy. And so when the federal government does that, I say no.
Can the state handle managing Social Security?
The state can handle managing something less than Social Security. For instance, if they want to give Medicaid to us in a block grant formula, I'd rather apply Medicaid funds here to Alaska's specific situation, not, you know, some Washington bureaucrat setting compliance and regulations for us to meet.
Mr. Berkowitz, the Tea Party movement, what do you make of it?
I think that the Tea Party movement is founded on two principles that I actually agree with. First, that Washington isn't working and local government isn't working. It's too partisan and it's all about who's going to win and not who's going to get things done. And that kind of frustration is part of what drove me to run this time again. We've got to make sure that government does the job that it's supposed to do. The other thing that drives the Tea Party is the recognition that we have to do more things for ourselves. And I agree with that. I just have a different set of answers than they might come up with. But I understand the two fundamental principles that are behind the Tea Party movement, and I agree with them.
What about this notion of shifting control to the state?
I think the state has an obligation to do as much for itself as it can. We're living in a time where the federal government is going to have less ability to do the things that it has done. And here in Alaska, we're very fortunate that we have ability to do much more than we have been doing. And I think because we have that ability, we have that responsibility.
Well, I'd like to shift the subject a little bit to one of the more pointed issues between the two of you, and that relates to natural gas. Governor Parnell, Mr. Berkowitz says that you got rolled on the forgiving TransCanada and Exxon $500 million. Did you get rolled?
You know, if you call a private sector project that's moving forward that actually has willing buyers and willing sellers compared to Mr. Berkowitz's project, which has neither, I'd say Alaska is making progress on a gas line. What we've got is we've got two projects now, the private sector moving forward. We've got the AGEA framework, which is TransCanada and Exxon. Major shippers committed significant volumes of gas into that pipeline. They're now negotiating their precedent agreement, like shippers and pipeline projects do all over this country. The Denali project with Conoco and BP announced the same thing. I'm a private sector guy. Ethan Berkowitz supports a government sector pipeline and a government produced pipeline. We're very different there. You're right.
Representative Berkowitz. What's your take on getting rolled?
Well, that's flat out untrue what Sean said. I don't support a public-owned thing. I support the idea of Alaskans having the chance to own a piece of the pipe. And I think that Sean Parnell did get rolled because he's essentially providing a $500 million bailout to TransCanada and Exxon. They've got engineers working away in Calgary trying to figure out how to get our gas through Canada. And that doesn't mean that Alaskans are going to benefit from it. And I don't know how Sean can make the statement that we've got willing buyers and willing sellers since this has been the results of the open season are still secret. We've got to make sure that we don't get trapped in AGEA, that we have a way to pursue a gas pipeline on Alaska's terms and that benefits Alaskans.
Okay, we'll get to some of these points in a bit here, but let's just to start off, Governor, a quick response to what Mr. Berkowitz just said.
Well, sure. Mr. Berkowitz just said that he doesn't support a public-owned project, but yet he embraces Bill Walker's publicly-owned project. So either he supports a government-funded, government-financed pipeline, or he's disavowing Bill Walker. It's one or the other, and he's either shifting his position or he's gonna stick to it tonight.
Okay. Relating to the $500 million.
Oh, sure.
Listener, let me just put, there's a listener, Paula Williams asks, and many people have asked the same question. She wants to know, why is it reasonable to pay $500 million to TransCanada without requiring that a pipeline be built?
Like oil exploration, where we say, if you make these kinds of investments here, you will get these tax credits. The same was done with AGEA. Up to $500 million was provided to in a competitive process to somebody who promised five offtakes for Alaska communities to get Alaska's gas, to the licensee who promised reasonable access terms and distance sensitive tariffs, meaning that the communities in this state only pay mileage on the gas from Prudhoe to that city, not paying mileage on the gas from Prudhoe to Chicago and back. That $500 million assured that other explorers get to explore Alaska's gas and get their gas into the pipeline on reasonable terms.
Mr. Berkowitz.
Well, I don't know why Sean opposes the All-Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline. I'm always sort of amazed when he says that. But what I've said all along is we need to develop Alaska's gas on Alaska's terms. And part of the reason we haven't done it is we haven't gone to the table with money in our pockets. And what I've proposed with giving Alaskans the ability to own a piece of the pipe, both as individuals, as businesses, and as corporations, is the ability for us to negotiate from a position of strength. We've always negotiated from a position of weakness and of desperation. And that will change the equation. It will give us a much better ability to develop gas on our terms. There's a lot of things we can do with developing in-state demand for gas so we can have some consumption here in-state that provides the revenue needed to sustain a gas pipeline.
Just one quick follow-up. Is it true, as one of a former Palin administration official suggested, that the number of offtake points in AGEA was determined by adding one, well, it's five because former Governor Murkowski wanted four?
You know,
and that was simply the reason for why there's five.
I wasn't in that particular discussion. That was a number of offtakes that were negotiated and publicly brought before the legislature, and the legislature made that decision, and Governor Palin signed off on that. The objective, though, the value was that Alaska communities deserve Alaska gas, and so any pipeline that gets built with incentives from the state is going to assure Alaska gas goes to Alaska communities.
Mr. Berkowitz. I'm hearing the phrase scrap AGEA, get on to something else, get away from the AGEA plan that is currently the permit that's being used right now. How do we get out of it? What do we have to do? Do we have to pay? It's going to cost because we've got a contract right now that'll promise us some payments.
Only if the open season is declared a success, and that's why every time Sean says that the open season is going well, it locks the state into a dangerous position, because what it essentially signals to TransCanada and Exxon is that we agree that AGEA has been successful. I don't think that's the case. When you have a proposal that's fraught with conditions the way that they are likely to come forward with, we ought to be doing everything we can to declare it a failure, because that gives us the ability to get out of that contract without having to pay treble damages. I don't understand why the legislature agreed to pay treble damages in the event the state had to withdraw.
Governor, what is the effect on jobs, people working? I mean, realistically, what sort of numbers are we talking about to get a pipeline, whichever focus happens to be? Will there be what's the realistic result of that? Are there going to be a lot of jobs, and how?
Well, of course there are, but let me just address statement just made by Mr. Berkowitz about scrapping AGEA. He shifted from a publicly financed gas pipeline, which was Bill Walker's position, which he embraced first. Now he's saying it's a private sector line. If it's a private sector line, it's going to go through an open season where shippers come in and nominate their gas, just like has already occurred with the Denali project and with the AGEA line. In other words, he wants to be back where we started. To your question, Dave, on jobs, thousands of jobs will be created in terms of construction. And at the Pipeline Training Center in Fairbanks, there are already people being trained up for these jobs as well as for maintaining existing pipelines.
Question that comes up, based on what you guys are talking about, Governor Parnell, why not release the results of the open season?
Well, I think that question reflects a misunderstanding of what the state has. The open season was not conducted by the state. The open season is a federally regulated process conducted between private parties, between the pipeline sponsor, the Alaska Pipeline Project, and pipeline shippers, BP, Conoco, Exxon, whoever else has gas in this state. So the state doesn't have information it's being held confidential. Instead, it has protected the state's interests by making sure that any pipeline project that goes through has those offtakes for communities, has distance-sensitive tariffs so that communities pay less for gas, and that's the reality of what's there.
Mr. Berkowitz.
Well, if Sean doesn't know the results, how can he say that they're willing buyers and willing sellers? Or, as he said on a different occasion, that there aren't willing buyers and willing sellers. I mean, it's got to be one or the other, and if he doesn't know, he isn't really in a position to say. And it's unfortunate that he chooses to continue to put this idea in the public that the results of the open season have been successful. That's not the case. I know that the conditions are bound to be conditions that we're going to find very difficult to meet. And we should be doing everything we can so that Alaska doesn't get caught paying these extra damages. We should be doing everything we can so that we have the flexibility we need in order to develop a gas line on our terms. And the $500 million, well, BP and Conoco didn't need that money.
Well, just kind of a bit of follow-up on that. What would be wrong with saying, yes, we had this number of bids with, 10, 15, 20 conditions, including fiscal certainty or what other, in broad terms. And that would sort of give pretty much an idea of what they contained. I mean, the oil companies have said all along they need fiscal certainty and several other things that they want, and they likely to attach those conditions. All of the people that ran for governor, basically, except I think for you, have argued this point that these results should be released before the election.
Well, I'd love to see them released. It's just that the state does not have these bid documents that you're talking about. These are bid documents between companies who have bid in a private sector competition. They have bid with the pipeline sponsor, Alaska Pipeline Project. And here's why the private sector doesn't disclose those bids, because the same shippers who bid into the Alaska Pipeline Project have bid into the Denali Project, and they are going to play each other off against the other to get the cheapest rates for their gas in either one of those pipelines. So the information is proprietary to those companies, and that's why those bids are kept secret between those companies until the precedent agreements are complete. Then it's made known what the terms are.
And when will those be complete?
For the Alaska Pipeline Project, the precedent agreements are scheduled to be complete by the end of December. For the Denali Project, by the end of January, early February.
Mr. Berkowitz.
When I did that white paper for Sarah Palin, one of the things I highlighted was the need for transparency from companies that are doing business with the state of Alaska. Companies might hide behind the requirement of proprietary information when they're dealing with other private individuals. But when you're dealing with a public resource like Alaska's gas, I think there's an affirmative obligation on the state to compel release of this information. I think there's an obligation on the part of the bidders and the sellers to release what that information is. It is not their gas they're talking about. It is our gas, and we ought to have access to that information. And it is the opposite of transparent. It is secretive government, and it should never occur that way in Alaska. And it never would under my administration.
Well, let's just...
Yeah, it's not...
Go ahead.
It's not secretive government. It's the free enterprise system where companies guard their information from other companies in a competitive process between the companies. This is not a government process. I understand that Ethan wants to create a government process, but this is not that. The private sector maintains their proprietary information when they're bidding against each other. This is no different than... then if Ethan has his way here, that means that government can get into every company's balance sheets, every company's books, and that simply is not the kind of system we have here.
Doesn't the AGEA process and the potential gain of $500 million make this much different than any other private sector deal that
might be made? Absolutely does. That's why at the end of the negotiation of the precedent agreements, they are required to protect Alaska's interests for that $500 million. They're required to make sure Alaska communities get gas at reasonable rates, let explorers get gas into that pipe at reasonable rates. When those precedent agreements become known through the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission early next year, that's when we will know what exactly the terms are, and we will already have protected Alaska's interests.
Okay, just a quick follow-up from it.
Alaska's governor should never protect Exxon. Alaska's governor should be protecting Alaska's interests. And here I'm hearing Sean say that he's going to protect Exxon's right to proprietary information instead of the right of all Alaskans to know what the conditions of those bids are. Because the disposition of that gas, the disposition of Alaska's resource, is something that's very public and should be very public. And this entire process all the way through should be visible and available for scrutiny from members of the Alaskan citizenry.
Okay, one final point on this, Dave, if okay. I might. I'm sorry all to right. hog the stage here, but on AGEA, when you say the Chan Parnell got rolled, I mean, the process was approved during the Palin administration. And if I remember right, the vote was 59-1.
And the one was right.
And the one was Ralph Samuels.
And he
the 59
was
included all the Democrats and all the other Republicans. So this was, you know, all basically not just at the feet of the incumbent governor.
The administration always had the ability to walk away from a deal. The administration always had the ability to say, we're not doing this because we didn't receive a sufficient number of bids or the conditions aren't acceptable to us. And if you don't have that kind of administrative discretion, then you're not exercising the power that you have as the most powerful governor in the country.
Let me interject another question here on the subject. This campaign has had a strong focus on oil and gas. This morning, the Oil and Gas Journal reported that there's been a 23% increase in U.S. production of gas since 2005. U.S. domestically produced gas that's being used now or ready to be used in the nation's market. Basically, Mr. Berkowitz, is there still a market for Alaska's gas?
Not through Canada, no, sir. That's why we've got to do it on our own and run a pipeline through the middle of the state where we can generate in-state demand, where we can and ultimately go to LNG, probably for export. But I want to make sure there's in-state demand for mining projects up north along the pipeline corridor around Livengood, for example. We can do server farms with it. We can do gas to liquids with it in the Fairbanks area. We can do things that will reduce the heating bills for people in the Fairbanks in the interior by $5,000 a year if we have offtake points. We can do things that we're providing power. But if we just say we're going to send our gas to Canada, that'll never happen. The tariff is too high. It costs too much.
23% in 5 years. 5 years ago, we were negotiating and trying to get people interested in doing a pipeline. Realistically, is it too late?
No. Listen, Ethan Berkowitz has proposed a government-built pipeline if he supports Bill Walker's pipeline. He's proposing building that pipeline first before knowing what the markets really are, before having willing buyers and willing sellers. If his plan is to build a private sector line, which he's now shifted to, then he's going to have an open season, just like we've had with AGEA. And that AGEA pipeline is designed to Valdez, to Tidewater, and it's designed to North American markets. So any willing buyer that wants to take Alaska's gas to the Asian markets or to North America could show up. The proof is in the pudding. I mean, major shippers announced that they had committed significant volumes of gas to that pipeline.
I don't know why you can say major shippers had made that commitment if the results aren't public.
Because they made those, each company made those announcements then they following
should,
the open season.
Then they should have taken the other step and disclosed what those commitments were. Because I'm just not willing to trust those people until we've seen the proof.
And neither am I. That's why we're going to see the proof in January.
Mr. Berkowitz, before the state subsidizes a small in-state gas pipeline, does it make sense to take that money and sit down with TransCanada and the three major North Slope producers and see if that same amount of money could be parlayed into making the big pipeline to the lower 48?
I think the first obligation we have is to make sure that gas comes through Alaska, not that gas comes through Canada. I'm sure once we get a pipeline going, we're going to have all kinds of interested people wanting to participate in operation and maintenance of the pipeline. But I want to make sure that we're doing this on Alaska's terms. I want to make sure that we have a viable project. The presence of shale gas in the lower 48 has all but rendered a pipeline that's going to run down the highway route and into the lower 48 or into Canada uneconomic. Gas is just too cheap in the lower 48. And that's why we need to make sure that we're doing things here in Alaska, developing our own demand and making sure that we have control over that gas. Plus, the issues about sovereignty haven't been resolved in Canada.
But not even a sit down and say, here's the pot of money we've got. What can you do with it? What can you make happen?
If people come to me, I'm always willing to listen, but I'm not going to them. That's negotiating from a position of weakness. And that's part of the problem the state has always had. We go on bended knee to the producers, to the people who have economic power, and we don't go from a position of strength. And we need to start acting like a sovereign state that we are and not like a colony. We've got to stop begging for people to do things for us, hoping that there's a confluence of interest between their shareholder concerns and the concerns of our state. And it is absolutely critical if we're going to be a sovereign state that we behave like one.
Governor Parnell?
I think it's complete bunk. I mean, what Ethan Berkowitz is suggesting is that we ought to go build a pipeline right now without having willing buyers and willing sellers for his project. The Alaska gas line that's publicly financed, which he originally supported. What we have is Ethan Berkowitz trying to convince you that I am only for a North American option through Canada. I've said all along that my first option is a Y option. That means design to Valdez and design through North America. Willing buyers and willing sellers show up in an open season. But I'm also the only person at this table who has a team actively working on an in-state gas line. That team has delivered preliminary cost estimates and preliminary engineering. It's on a strict timeline set by the legislature for 2011 delivery of project deliverables. So bottom line is I'm pursuing all avenues to commercialize Alaska's gas.
And that team has stated very clearly that the in-state option that you're pursuing is going to require massive state subsidy.
Which is exactly why we're pursuing all options, whether it's the North American option, the Valdez option, or the in-state option. Whichever gas gets to Alaskans and markets beyond first, that's what we're going to do.
So why don't you let Alaskans buy into the pipeline? Why won't you let private Alaskans participate?
I'm happy to do that, but what Ethan Berkowitz is suggesting is a little bit disingenuous. He says it's a private pipeline because Alaskans can invest in it. If Alaskans invested 20% of their permanent fund dividends, that would raise about $160 million on a $26 billion project. I think it's great if Alaskans want to invest, but I think you got to have a project first with willing buyers and willing sellers before you try to sell a phony stock certificate.
Let's go to Dermot.
A couple points on this. Now, for what the governor just referred to, Mr. Berkowitz, if there are commercial companies that are interested in building a pipeline to Valdez and shipping LNG to the Far East or wherever, won't they have made bids? Won't they have participated in the open season process?
And if, I
they
don't know.
And if they did not participate in the open season process, does that tell us something? Does that tell us that they believe that this is not an economic a project? And plus, there's another issue here. The Middle East, or the Far East, is long pitched as the ultimate place to sell Alaska gas because of the high price of gas being that's received there. But in the Middle East, there are vast stores of natural gas, and if China, Japan, and other areas become willing to sign long-term contracts, they would have an advantage over Alaska, would they not?
With the Middle East?
The Middle East, yes.
I think there's some tremendous advantages for Alaskan gas moving to those parts of the world because we're a lot closer, because we're a secure port. We're not rife with the kind of political strife that they have there. We're not in a military hot zone the way they are in the Middle East. So there's some tremendous advantages to dealing with Alaska gas. There's tremendous advantages in terms of petrochemical industry developing at Tidewater here in Alaska. We've got a lot of great advantages based on our location in the world, and we ought to exploit those.
We do have advantages, but we also have cost disadvantages because it's much cheaper in the Middle East.
Dermot, your point is correct. That AGEA line was designed to go to Valdez and designed to go to North America. If willing buyers and willing sellers are there for a private sector project like Ethan Berkowitz describes, they will have shown up. And we will know by January whether or not willing buyers and sellers showed up for that one or whether they showed up for the North American option. Frankly, I mean, the proof is in the competitive process, in the private sector process. If Ethan Berkowitz says he's going to run a private sector process, he's basically going to throw out what's already been done and start over again. That doesn't sound reasonable either.
Let's change direction a little bit.
Oh,
gentlemen,
we have
not heard our buzzer go off once tonight, so you're doing a great job of keeping things moving. But we're going to get even a little quicker here with a lightning round. 15 seconds for these responses. Governor, you mentioned that you've been at 23 debates so far this election season
This is my 23rd, correct.
And you've had 11 so far in the general election between the two of you, something around that
Who's
number.
Who's counting? It's so much fun.
So what have people not been asking you about that you want to talk about, Governor Parnell?
You know, we actually have been so focused on the economic issues, oil, gas, mining, timber, the federal encroachment, and how we're fighting that we haven't really focused on the family issues. We haven't focused on education. We haven't focused on domestic violence and sexual assault. With education, and
we'll get to some education questions.
All right.
Mr. Berkowitz.
Yeah, the education questions are absolutely critical, and we haven't even really touched on what we're going to do for renewable energy policy in the state and how we're going to expand low-cost energy to people who need it. We haven't really talked about what we're going to do to make rural Alaska a much more, talking about village survival and village sustainability, and there's a lot there.
Let's really change the subject.
Are these lightning round questions?
Yes, these are still, yes. There's a bill in Congress right now giving Sea Alaska, the Native Corporation, the opportunity to select lands outside of the original ANCSA selections. Do you support it, Governor?
The bill that Sea Alaska put in, which brings their conveyances to them that they are entitled to, I do support them getting the lands that they're entitled to, but where that bill has gotten to in Congress is it's also got about 186,000 acres of land that's tied up with it by the environmental community. I don't support that part of it. It needs more work.
Mr. Berkowitz?
I think Sea Alaska has a right to make the land selections. I think there's some difficulties in Southeast with other interested parties. I would suggest the state could be a good broker there if we helped do some land exchange where perhaps we were willing to exchange state land for some of the Sea Alaska selections.
Thank you.
California is voting on whether to legalize marijuana on Tuesday. Should Alaska legalize marijuana, and should we get some taxes from it? Mr. Berkowitz.
Well, I think that the state's laws about pot are probably as good as we need to be. We've got the privacy protections, and I don't think we need to go further. We've got a big problem in the state with drug and alcohol abuse, and before we take that next step, I think we're good where we are.
Governor Parnell?
I do not support legalizing marijuana. In fact, we're going to need to address spice, which is that synthetic marijuana. We're going to need to address that in the upcoming legislative session. So the answer is no. It's a gateway drug. No, no way.
All right. This next question comes to us from Owen Guthrie, who asks, of the following two numbers, which more accurately represents the age of the Earth in years, 6,000 or 6 billion? Governor Parnell.
Only God knows.
Well, I guess that's
you're the governor. What's your guess?
Mr. Berkowitz.
I'll go with 6 billion.
Okay.
You really don't want to answer that?
I really don't know. I mean, for either one of us to do it, it's quite speculative.
Okay.
Yeah. There's been a lot of talk recently. Do you support a road to Nome, Mr. Berkowitz?
You know, with all these big projects, I want to see how people are going to finance it. And this is one of the difficulties we get into is we have these great projects, but until there's a business plan for how we're going to finance it from beginning to end and then operations and maintenance, we've got to prioritize state spending. We've got to pick and choose among which infrastructure projects are going to go first.
Kevin?
You know, I think that's one of the differences between Ethan Berkowitz and I is that I want to build roads to resources. I want to build roads to communities that want them. So this last year, I helped and proposed funding $8 million to build a road to Umiat, which opens access to those oil and gas rich lands.
This would be $3 billion road. Yes,
yes, but
I check my numbers here.
But Dave, we've already taken that in bite-sized chunks. So this year, there are three routes to Nome. One of those includes going to the Ambler Mining District. We partnered with the legislature, appropriated funds to take a road to the Ambler Mining District. Well, we funded the first two seasons of work. Bottom line is, we'll create jobs along the way to Nome.
Let me just add, one of the things that's not really up for discussion is a railroad to Nome, and we ought to contemplate that as well.
Are humans contributing to global climate change through fossil fuel emissions, Mr. Berkowitz?
Yes, and you can measure it with not just climate change, but it's quantifiable with ocean acidification.
Governor?
And yes, but far less than volcanoes.
Okay.
All right. Should the state capital be moved to South Central Alaska? Some say we've already have dual capitals because only a couple of our state commissioners now still live in Juneau. Governor Parnell.
The question being, should the capital be moved to South Central?
Yes.
The answer is no. I won't be pitting one area of the state against the other when it comes to ripping an economy out of one part of the state and moving it to another. That kind of redistribution is not something I support.
Well, I'm looking forward to moving to the Capitol in Juneau. So I'd like it to stay there so I don't get lost on the way. But the other thing I'd like to mention, Jay Hammond had a great idea of putting the legislature on a barge and towing it around the state. Having been in the legislature and having viewed how they see the governor, I'd like to put them on a barge.
Well, let's just follow up on that quickly. What do we have this situation? At one time in Alaska, the state commissioners did live in Juneau. But now, basically, they live in Anchorage. And for the people,
that's not true for all of them.
Well, I believe it's true for all of them except two.
Okay.
Is that kind of out of balance there in terms of, regional issues?
Well, I watched one governor try to place the requirement on commissioners to live in Juneau, and that particular governor went through six people for one commissioner post before finding one that was willing to serve. I want to make sure that the person who serves is where the job is.
Well, I'd like to have my commissioners close to me. I'm looking forward to having Republicans and Democrats and Independents serve with me. And if we're going to have the good kind of conversation that's going to yield good policy, they need to be sitting at the table.
There's been a national, some issues have come up recently, has led to a lot of national discussion about federal funds being used for public broadcasting, radio and television. Should the state continue to support public radio and television?
How many minutes or seconds do we have on this one?
15.
And I'm going first?
Governor.
Well, in Alaska, public broadcasting is essential for safety in many of our coastal communities and many of our communities. I have supported public broadcasting, and provided they stay within those professional bounds of journalism, I see no issue there, especially in this great land of ours.
Mr. Berwitz.
I support public broadcasting and, in fact, a member of several public broadcasting stations around the state.
Thank you.
Listener Mark Fish asks if you own a firearm, and if you own more than one, what's your favorite? Mr. Berkowitz.
I do. Can I tell a story?
You have 15 seconds.
Representative Richard Foster gave it to me, and he said it was a general's gun, and he tucked it in his waistband. He says it's a general's gun, but don't shoot your privates.
Governor Parnell, can you beat that?
I'm just going to talk about a Remington 870, and that's about it. I cannot top that one.
Okay.
All right. Should the Healy Clean Coal Plant, one of our old friends, be reactivated? And if so, when? Mr. Berkowitz.
If we can make the Healy Clean Coal Plant work, so it's yes, then we should reactivate it.
Governor.
And we found a point we agree on. If it can work, let's make it work. Let's bring all kinds of energy we can to bear to reduce energy costs in the interior in particular.
Let's take a moment now and give you guys a chance to ask questions of each other. You'll have a minute to respond to the question, and then 30 seconds to do sort of a wrap-up or a rebuttal. We'll start with you, Governor Parnell, a question from Mr. Berkowitz.
Ethan, one of the things that you and I have done together is worked budgets together in the Alaska legislature in the late 90s when oil was at $9 a barrel. I was a Senate Finance co-chair, and you were a minority leader, I believe, at the time. And we had a fiscal plan to reduce the budget by $250 million. At that time, I was working to cut the budget, and you were working to raise the budget with amendments. Can you talk about why, in that time of fiscal crisis, you were working to raise the budget instead of helping us cut the budget?
Well, Sean, given that you've been responsible for the largest state budgets in state history, the small amounts I was looking to do back then, which were for VPSOs, for troopers, for students in schools, these are all projects that you now support. So had we made those initial investments earlier, perhaps we could have saved money in the long term by doing it right at the right time.
30 seconds.
Well, when it comes to reducing spending, as finance co-chair in the 90s, I made sure that we met that $250 million budget cut target. As governor last December, I introduced a budget that was $1.2 billion less than what the legislature passed, and I vetoed their budget to record levels for any chief executive that I'm aware of, and did it while maintaining the support in the legislature for those cuts.
Okay, let's flip things around.
My turn?
Yes.
Sean, during the course of this campaign, I've talked about the Alaskan ownership stake. It's a five-part plan I've rolled out to Alaskans can be closer to our resources. The third part of that plan is a reduction in corporate income taxes. And I put that forward because currently we rank last in the country in terms of our business climate. As part of this plan, I suggested we reduce the corporate income tax from 9.4 to 4.9% and provide all measure of credits to encourage job growth and investment in this state. Why do you oppose that plan?
I have not opposed that plan, Ethan. Instead, I'm happy to have you work with me on reducing those taxes. What kind of amazes me, though, is that you wouldn't join us in reducing royalties or taxes here in Cook Inlet to promote oil exploration and those jobs. You wanted to create a state income tax when you were in the legislature rather than cut people's taxes. I've worked to reduce Alaskans' tax at the gasoline pump. I've worked to reduce the tourism head tax. I've proposed tax credits to get people working on the North Slope and in Cook Inlet. So I'm happy to have you join me, and I'll join you on reducing those small business taxes. But the bottom line is, that's a change of heart for who you've been in the past.
Well, I've always been someone who's believed in having jobs and a good economic climate in the state. That's why I supported a long-range fiscal plan. That's why I joined with people like Lisa Murkowski and Andrew Halcrow to do what the business community of the state asked us to do, which is prepare a parachute so that when the state, or if the state, went off a fiscal cliff, we'd have a soft, cushioned landing. I'm sorry you continue to mischaracterize it as a form of tax. It was a plan designed to help Alaskans avoid the worst kind of economic catastrophe since the 80s.
The state income tax Ethan Berkowitz voted for was a singular piece of legislation. Yes, it was in the context of his discussions with the Fiscal Policy Council, but the choice was made. Pass the state income tax now. Ethan Berkowitz supported it. When I was in the legislature, I voted against the state income tax. I commit to you, I will not impose a state income tax.
Let's get a response, Mr. Berkowitz.
Yeah, the response is it was part of a bundle of proposals that were going to kick in if oil, if the state's reserves dropped to unsustainable levels. And it was designed to stop once we climbed out of the pit. And frankly, the plan that you put forward of cutting the budget, which you didn't actually do, you relied on Ted Stevens and the federal money he brought in to backfill the problem, just wasn't going to work, and it wasn't working.
Let's move on to a question from Dave Donaldson. 45 seconds to answer.
Alaska, according to your website, Mr. Berkowitz, Alaska is 4 years away from the shutdown of the Trans-Alaska oil pipeline, and it basically economic collapse for the state. First of all, what do you base that on, and what would you do about it?
Those are based on some statements of former Conoco leader Kevin Myers, and what we need to do about it, and he talked about a shutdown at 500,000 barrels a day. We're currently at about 619,000 barrels a day, and at this current rate of decline, we'll be in shutdown mode in 4 years. What I propose to do about it is improve the investment climate so we're not looking at a pipeline shutdown. You look at what's gone on over the last couple of years since the ACES program was introduced and supported by Sean. We've seen declining production, we've seen job loss, and we've seen a loss of investment, and we've got to reverse that.
Can it be reversed in 4 minutes, in 4 years?
Well, it can be reversed in 30 seconds if we have the right kind of policy. And the policy I've talked about doing is changing from the system we have now, which is a one-size-fits-all system, and customizing our approach on a project-by-project or field-by-field basis, doing it by contract. Because if you do it by contract, you generate fiscal certainty. Okay. And when you have fiscal certainty, you can also get work commitments that will benefit the state. It is a competitive kind of proposal that exists around the world.
Governor, how close is the shutdown here?
You know, this is the stark difference between me and Ethan Berkowitz. I proposed infill drilling tax credits, changes to ACES last year that would have put hundreds of people to work this summer, produced more oil production. We've got to fill the pipe. We've got to make Alaska more competitive worldwide. And that's why I proposed a two-part plan to modify ACES, and that is to cap progressivity at those high tax rates and give tax credits for technically challenged fields. What Ethan Berkowitz is proposing, or what he proposed first, was to renegotiate every lease in this state to increase the royalty rate and do that all by contract. That's a make-work project for lawyers, and that's really all it is. It would destabilize and kill jobs here. Instead, we need modifications to ACES to fill that pipeline.
We're going to need to take a short break now. Thanks so much to Dave Donaldson of APRN for joining us for this half of the program. We'll be right back.
Yeah. After tonight's debate, sponsored by AARP, visit aarp.org/yourvote to find out where the candidates stand. Because it's your right, your decision, your vote. Paid for by AARP.
Good evening. My name is Steve Lindbeck. I'm the President and General Manager for Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated here in Anchorage. On behalf of public broadcasters from across Alaska, I want to welcome you to tonight's debate for the state. We're coming to you from the studios of KAKM Channel 7 in Anchorage, but this debate is a collaboration among talented colleagues from KTOO Juneau, KUAC Fairbanks, KYUK Bethel, and the entire Alaska Public Radio Network. Alaska's public broadcasters are committed to fair, accurate, and authentic news coverage and thoughtful and engaging public affairs programming. This good work only happens because you, the viewer and listener, make generous contributions in your own communities. Thank you for making this good work possible. Thank you for becoming informed about the candidates and issues facing us all. And thank you for going to the polls next week to vote. Now, let's go back live to Alaska Public Broadcasting's Debate for the State.
Go to aarp.org/yourvote today to find out where the candidates stand. And be sure to vote on November 2nd.
Good evening and welcome back to Debate for the State. We're joined by Lori Townsend of the Alaska Public Radio Network. Thanks, Lori. Now, candidates, you have 45 seconds to answer some questions. Dermot Cole has our first one.
All right, let's move to education. A listener in Galena asked this question. Should the Molly Hooch system of high schools in every village be maintained, or should it be abandoned in favor of a regional model using boarding schools? Mr. Berkowitz.
I think we can do both. I think the Molly Hooch school system made it possible for Alaskans in rural Alaska to get quality schools, and the people who fought for that fought a just battle, and we should continue it. The students of rural Alaska need options, just as the students in urban Alaska need options. Boarding schools are part of those options. And you look at a community like Galena, which has four or five different schools. It has distance delivery there. They've got a cosmetology school. They've got a pilot school. They've got a regular high school. They've got all kinds of things. We've got to have diversity of choice if we're going to attract Alaskan students and hold them. 60% of Alaskan students in rural Alaska aren't completing high school. We need to do something different.
Governor.
One of the things I made sure this year was that rural Alaska school construction projects were treated on a parallel basis with the more urban areas. Those school construction projects were designed to make sure that rural children have the same opportunities in classrooms that are safe and warm as school children in every other community in this state. When it comes to the regional schools that you spoke to, I too believe that rural Alaskans need more choices. We can have more Mount Edgecombes. We can have better quality schools all around this state, different models, with the free choice of parents and students being exercised in that.
All right, thank you.
Lori.
The governor has been at odds with the federal government on a number of fronts. You're suing over the polar bear listing, the beluga habitat, also the health care legislation. Mr. Berkowitz, would you drop those lawsuits, or what would you do differently?
No, I don't think I'd drop those lawsuits. I think you have to have a certain amount of respect for the choices that were made by a prior governor. And when I'm governor, I'll respect Sean's choices. But I'm also going to make sure we have other tools in our arsenal. And I wanted to take a second to address the health care issue, because in particular, that implicates an important constitutional provision. I've always been concerned when the federal government overreaches using the Commerce Clause. And I think the provisions of the federal health care bill that compel people to affirmatively purchase health insurance overreach, and it should be challenged. It doesn't take away from the necessity of developing an Alaskan-based health care program for our people.
And Governor Parnell, are there other ways that this could be done other than litigation?
Well, a couple things. First off, Ethan Berkowitz supported President Obama's health care plan, pure and simple. I opposed it. I joined Florida and about 20 other states in suing the federal government on that individual mandate, because that is the first time the federal government has required an American to buy a product, whether or not a person wants it or not. When it comes to is suing the only option, the answer is no. In fact, when the Department of Agriculture was holding up a timber sale in Southeast Alaska, I went directly to Secretary Vilsack and argued for those jobs. The logjam timber sale went through. Prince of Wales Islands, Viking Sawmill, those jobs were moving this year, this summer, on that timber.
Governor Parnell, mentioning the health care lawsuit, Democrats have accused you of foot dragging and implementing some of the more popular provisions for state employees. Senator Hollis French says you're delaying as long as legally possible provisions like getting kids staying on their parents' health insurance plans until age 26. And he and other Democrats are upset that you're not offering the Health Care Act benefits to state retirees. States aren't required to do that, but some are. It's an option. Do they have some validity in saying you're holding back?
Well, it's true that Senator French and Ethan Berkowitz are on one side of that universal coverage and want government health care. I don't. So when I'm accused of foot dragging, what I'm doing is taking each deadline in the federal legislation on a case-by-case basis. For example, when the federal government says, here's some money to go set up a health insurance exchange, but you don't have to do it till 2014, but you ought to maybe start doing it now, and here's the money if you want to buy in a little bit, I said no, because let's finish this lawsuit and see if the individual mandate gets overturned. That will directly bear on the health insurance exchanges, and we've got 3 years more, 4 years more, before we have to buy into a system that right now I don't buy.
Mr. Berkowitz, you surprised some Democrats by saying you'd actually stick with the lawsuit over the health care law.
That doesn't mean we don't have a responsibility to find health care solutions for Alaskans. And I've also been very clear that we need to do things here in state. We need to take better care of ourselves. We have to pursue some of the options that are available through the health care bill. The health care bill makes it possible for Alaskans to buy insurance over state lines. It allows small businesses to pool together. It allows for supplemental payment of Medicaid or Medicare. So if a patient goes to a doctor and the doctor says, I can't lose money on you, and the patient says, fine, I'll give you the extra money either through cash or through additional insurance, we've got to do more for growing doctors and nurses in this state. We need more with telemedicine. We've got to do things, because fighting the federal government doesn't help someone who's hurt or sick.
In 15 seconds, would you try to bump up the timeline for getting state employees some of the benefits?
Absolutely, I would bump up the timelines, because every day we delay is a delay that people who might be beneficiaries of that kind of health care aren't receiving it. And we can have these good academic distinctions between what we want to do and what policy should be, but real people are suffering in the crossfire.
Well, but
sorry, we need to move on to Dermot.
Well, so. I think I'd like to give the governor just a short rebuttal to that.
That's ridiculous to make that kind of an assertion. I just spoke with a small business owner who said that they just got their health insurance premiums notice, and it was raised 46%. When they went back to their insurer, they said, the insurance company said it's because of the new mandates imposed by federal health care legislation. I am not going to let us get sucked into a system without having a court fight when it's going to raise insurance premiums by 46%.
Okay, at the risk of going on too long, Representative Berkowitz.
When Sean cut the additions to Denali, the Denali Kid Care, those were real kids, 1,200, 1,300 kids with names and faces and families who aren't getting the health care that they deserve. It's all those expectant mothers who aren't getting the health care that they deserve. And I understand his philosophical objection to it, but real people need real treatment.
All right, just one quick question. You can answer this both in the short time, I think. We do have a severe shortage of doctors who take Medicare patients in Alaska. In Anchorage, it's a pretty big problem, and in other Alaska cities as well. What can the state do about that, Mr. Berkowitz?
Well, I think there's some movement to create virtual clinics that people in the legislature have supported. I would pursue those kind of things. We need to make sure that the state recognizes the ability for supplemental payments, which I believe is part of some of the national legislation.
Governor?
Listen, only 17% of our primary care providers are accepting new Medicare patients. There is a huge problem with access for our senior population. There's no question. But this last year, I supported appropriating money to a Medicare clinic. It's a joint venture between state funding, private funding, nonprofit funding that will only address Medicare patients and will provide better access than what they have now.
Lori.
Governor Parnell, you call your campaign against domestic violence and sexual assault Choose Respect. But sexual predators never choose respect. How effective are slogans? Where are the teeth in this campaign?
I think that's what's been most offensive is those kinds of comments from our opposition when they refer to a comprehensive initiative on domestic violence and sexual assault as a dog and pony show. Those were Diane Benson's comments. Here's what a comprehensive initiative looks like, known as Choose Respect. It means getting tougher on perpetrators. It means tougher sentences that were passed this past year. It means 15 more VPSOs in the villages. It means that in 2008, we had 43 VPSOs in the villages. By 2011, we'll have 101 VPSOs. It means prevention. It means choosing respect among each other as men and as boys and as women and as girls.
Sean, I think you go too far when you challenge Diane Benson's authority on this subject matter. She is a survivor of domestic violence and sexual assault. She has been an outstanding spokesman for the kind of programs we should have to treat it. And the criticism she levels at your program is it's designed primarily for high school students. It's patterned after a CDC program that is for date rape. It is not a comprehensive approach. We need a far more comprehensive approach than you have offered.
And so if you would not continue the Choose Respect campaign, which I'm assuming that's what you're saying, what would you do?
What I'm saying is the Choose Respect program is one patch in a quilt. And we need to do more. We need to make sure that there's housing available for people to escape domestic violence. We need to make sure that we can do what's done in other states and have domestic violence types courts so you can break some of these cycles. We need to make sure that you have more victim services than we've had. It's not just a law enforcement problem, and we've got to stop treating it that way.
You know, he just spoke to my comprehensive initiative. Get tougher on perpetrators, provide more shelter and services for survivors or victims, and the prevention aspect. That is Choose Respect. That is the entire campaign to get rid of this epidemic within 10 years.
That was not the campaign when it was initially designed. And fortunately, the people who were experienced in domestic violence were able to influence your decisions and move you in a better direction.
Well, regarding crime in rural areas, what can be done in the short term while the VPSO slots are waiting to be filled, Governor?
At this point, VPSO slots are being filled. In 2008, there were 43 VPSOs filled positions. By 2011, that'll be 101 VPSOs. But we need to do more than just fill those slots. We also need to provide housing for the VPSOs. And AHFC right now is working on a pilot program to move forward on VPSO housing. Three new VPSO housing units are being built at this point in three villages. My commitment was to continue funding 15 new VPSOs until every village that wants a VPSO has one.
Mr. Berkowitz.
It's going to take a comprehensive approach. And I prosecuted crimes in rural Alaska for a number of years. I learned mostly how little people in urban Alaska understand the difficulties of doing law and order in rural Alaska. We need to have a system that's more than VPSOs. We need to make sure that there's drug and alcohol treatment in the regions, or if not in the villages. We need to make sure that if we're going to incarcerate people, we can do it locally so they can be close to their families and have culturally relevant programs. Because we've already got a problem where 40% of the people incarcerated in Alaska are Alaska Natives. We're not doing justice in rural Alaska. We have got to do better.
The state fought the Federal Tribal Law and Order Act, and now Senator Begich has a proposal that he's calling the Safe Villages and Families Act. Will you support that, Governor?
Not in its current form. I really believe in that partnership between the state and the tribes, the federally recognized tribes, in those administrative or programmatic areas, like the therapeutic courts, like the domestic violence sexual assault funding, like the transportation funding, like the substance abuse funding. But what Senator Begich is working to do is create criminal jurisdiction for tribal courts. And that is something that, as a governor who raised my right hand and swore an oath to the Constitution of this state, I cannot support that extended criminal jurisdiction, but I will continue to support those programmatic partnerships that we have and can engage in.
Mr. Berkowitz, was it a mistake for the state not to support the Tribal Law and Order Act? And would you get behind Senator Begich's proposal?
Well, I haven't read Senator Begich's act. I've been busy running my own campaign here. But I will tell you that it is the law in this state, based on Supreme Court decisions, that we have to recognize the criminal jurisdiction of tribal courts. And for Sean to say that because he's raised his right hand to uphold the Constitution doesn't give him license to ignore duly constituted, duly formed judgments from the state Supreme Court. He has to abide by the law. Abiding by the law is not something you can do selectively. You can't just choose the aspects of Supreme Court decisions you agree with and uphold them and not uphold the ones you disagree with.
Lori? Well, let's talk about that a little bit. The state challenged the CalTag tribal court adoption case. This was a case that the tribe found a family that wanted to adopt a child that was in egregious situation, everything went well. The parents didn't protest the termination of their parental rights. The trouble came when the tribal court requested a new birth certificate for this child, and the state refused it, saying that the court did not have the authority to initiate a case, only to receive a case from the state court based on a Greg Rehnquist, a former attorney general's decision. The state took this case to the U.S. Supreme Court. Why did the state fight this case so far?
In that case, it was because the court in CalTag was exercising jurisdiction over another tribal court member. It wasn't exercising jurisdiction over one of its own members. That is a distinction at law. You're right. The court found that the state's position was not the correct position under the law, and the state will be taking steps following that related to Indian Child Welfare Act cases, adoption cases.
And so
that's totally different than criminal jurisdiction.
But what will the state do now that that has been a mandate? The U.S. Supreme Court refused to hear it, and so now the lower court's ruling will stand. How will the state meet that mandate?
Well, that's something that I would ask my attorney general right now to address with you, rather than me try to prognosticate on what the new policy will be following that.
You haven't had conversations about it yet?
I have had a briefing on the decision, but in terms of a path forward, we're talking a comprehensive policy that is going to take some time to develop.
And Mr. Berkowitz, do you think that was the right decision to take it to the Supreme Court?
I think that the perception in rural Alaska has been that there's such an overwhelming hostility to recognition of tribes. It's one of the reasons we have the urban-rural divide in this state. I didn't see the decision. I don't know why the decision was made, but I know that we have to do more than we have done to bridge that urban-rural divide. I think the Millennium Agreement that Governor Knowles launched, where there was state recognition of tribes, is a step in the right direction, and we should continue along that path.
Well, and to continue that line of discussion, we're talking about protecting children, mm-hmm. which is something that yep. you've made a strong point of your platform. What's wrong with letting the tribal courts do these things? They're the first line of defense. They're in these communities. How does that hurt the state's sovereignty?
Well, again, that CalTag case was between tribal members of different tribes. And again, I will have to defer to my attorney general on what the legal ramifications are going forward.
Mr. Berkowitz?
I think what we need to do is make sure that children are protected. And my experience in rural Alaska is that there's just no justice in too many places, and children aren't being protected. And I was a big proponent of what's known as restorative justice when I was in the legislature. It's one of the achievements that I'm proud of. I didn't list it with Dermot's first question. But it allowed local people to have more control when there's an absence of the state authority. And there is no state authority in CalTag. I've been to CalTag more than one occasion, and the children there deserve protection. If the tribal court was the court that was providing protection, it's not right for the state to interfere with that child.
Thank you.
Let's move to a lightning round. 15 seconds to answer. Governor Parnell, are you standing by your endorsement of Joe Miller for U.S. Senate?
I'm standing my endorsement of the people's vote in the primary, as Ethan Berkowitz has stood by Scott McAdams as his primary winner.
Well, I think he just answered my question for you, which is, who are you picking to win the U.S. Senate race? Who do you want to win?
Well, that's a different question.
We can get into the crystal ball reading if you want, but we'll just play it safe and go, who are you endorsing?
I'll be voting for Scott McAdams.
Okay. Lori.
Do you think the charges against Senator Al Kukesh should have been pursued? He was accused of salmon fishing outside of his subsistence allotment. Governor Parnell?
I don't think that a governor should get into a prosecutor's discretion. That's not something that we do as elected officials. We leave that independent judgment up to prosecutors, and I think that's where it should stand.
Mr. Berkowitz.
Well, I agree with Sean. The governor shouldn't be making individual prosecutorial decisions. But in that particular case, the state had failed to follow the proper procedures in promulgating the regulations. And what it highlights is the lack of progress on subsistence.
Dermot?
Governor, I was thinking about this last night after our discussion with Don Young, and one of our listeners asked about it today, too. Said Congressman Young said that you should kiss him for calling you Captain Zero when you ran against him. He said, otherwise you could have won the election and not become governor. Do you want to say thanks to Don Young?
Oh, thank you, Don Young. Yeah. You know, it's But I do want to say that I think that, I mean, I appreciate the congressman's comments, but I have to tell you that I think that we need a new civility in elections. I think it's okay to compare and contrast between us as candidates, but I think we need more civility in the, in this election process. We're sick and tired of the name calling.
Mr. Berkowitz, you did an ad standing next to a backhoe. In an outtake on your website, you got whacked pretty hard on the shoulder by the backhoe, and I'd like to know, did that scare you as much as it scared me?
Only when I saw it, but my mother saw it. She laughed. She said it was okay. But I caution people not to do that ever again.
Okay. Don't do this. Yes. Don't do this on
this
TV.
Is one of those parental things. Do
don't
as
try
I
this
say,
at home.
Not
don't
as I do.
Well, but listen, construction folks all around this state were disturbed by that. Yeah. And safety is a huge issue. And it is inculcated in the construction industry, in the oil industry. Hard hats, Ethan.
Well, hard hats, hard heads, and we'll just leave it at that. I'll cut off the comments I could make. But
all right. Thank you. Lori.
Mr. Berkowitz,
if someone were to write a book about you, what would the title be?
Oh, wow. I'd hope they'd like to say he energized Alaska.
And Governor Parnell.
I'd say freedom and family.
All right. Well, Governor, if someone were to write a book about your opponent, what would the title be?
About my opponent? The biography of Ethan Berkowitz.
And Mr. Berkowitz, if someone were to write a book about your opponent?
I would say that Sean Parnell, the man, the myth.
No legend.
Once again, back to civility. Huh?
Okay.
Let's talk about the ballot next week. In addition to choosing candidates for office, voters will be also asked whether to spend $400 million in bonds on a variety of projects, including a sports center at the University of Alaska Anchorage, a life sciences center in Fairbanks, and some schools in rural Alaska. Do you support it, Mr. Berkowitz?
Yes.
Governor Parnell?
Yes, I do.
Should the taxpayers, or should the people of Alaska really be paying up to almost $90 million for a sports complex at a university?
Well, listen, I supported the UAF Life Sciences Building in my initial budget and initial proposal. And the interest rate on these public facilities it's exceedingly low. It's akin to 3% or so. So not only will it produce construction jobs, it'll produce business investment and research opportunities for the university as well as some rural schools.
And a sports facility.
And a sports facility.
Did you have concerns? We've heard some criticism, people saying, should we really collectively be contributing to a sports facility?
It's part of the university structure, yes.
Okay, next question, Lori.
Mr. Berkowitz, do you support ballot measure 1, which would expand the legislature from 60 to 66 members?
Absolutely. It is not the solution that I would have done to make sure that rural Alaska, in fact, all of Alaska outside of Anchorage and the MATSU had fair representation. It's in a response to a very poorly written ballot measure that occurred in 1997 that required us to have single member districts. So yes, I support it.
Governor Parnell.
Yes, I do. When these districts were originally constructed, we had about 250,000 people. Now we're at 660,000. We've got one district that's basically the size of California. I think people deserve better representation than
bigger
that.
Bigger than California, Texas.
Texas.
Thank you.
Who's counting?
Small states, yes. All of them.
Under the WAMI program, which sends Alaskans to medical school, the state subsidizes tuition for students to attend schools outside. Should the number of students who are being sent to medical school be increased under this program, Governor?
Well, and the answer is yes. The answer is yes. I've expanded those WAMI seats, I believe, to 10 or more at this point.
Well, the suggestion has been that the raise be 30, that it be raised to 30 and eventually to 50 by the Alaska Physician
Supply
Task Force.
You didn't explain that as part of your question, Jeremy. But the answer is, yes, I will continue to support the WAMI program and reasonable increases to get more doctors into this state.
All right, thank you.
We should have a medical school. Why are we exporting?
Can Alaska afford a medical school?
Can we afford not to have a medical school? We're taking our best and brightest, we're exporting them to Washington, and they're doing all kinds of things down there. They don't all come back. We should be importing other bright people to come into the state and be doctors here, help fill the doctor shortage we have. It will save us money in the long term, and it's what a grown-up state should have.
Well, we don't even have to go that far. We've got a nursing school with a waiting list where people are graduating or are taking the coursework here and then going outside for nursing school. We could increase the number of nursing seats as well here.
You want to respond, nursing school?
We have a nursing school, I agree, we should do it. But this is.
But you want more?
I want more. This is part of taking care of ourselves. If we're going to have a strategy in this state of taking care of ourselves, we've got to grow our own, we've got to train our own, and mm-hmm. that way we'll keep them here.
Let's give the candidates another chance to quiz each other. Gentlemen, you have 1 minute to respond and then a 30-second rebuttal. Mr. Berkowitz, go ahead.
Sean, during the last 2 years, you violated the Constitution twice by hiring two sitting legislators for newly created jobs. The Constitution is very clear. That cannot happen. Someone who's in the legislature has to wait until a year after their term would expire. Do you have any remorse for that, number one? And number two, there are rumors that one of those people is in line for a job with your administration. Is that true?
The allegation that I violated the Constitution is patently false. What is true is that in September of 2009, I wanted to hire Senator Jean Terrio into my administration. I went to the Attorney General. I got a legal opinion on doing that because that practice has been done for 50 years, beginning with Bill Ligon. The Constitution does not prohibit every legislator from serving less than a year after they've left office. There are exceptions. I wanted to be clear on those exceptions because I want to make sure that this administration is one of integrity and follows the law. I did the same with Nancy Dahlstrom. When the Attorney General changed his mind about three opinions later, I said, enough, no more. I will not hire any more legislators unless they've been out of office for a year. That policy is still in place.
The difference between the people who had been in the legislature in prior administrations, they were all hired for sitting or existing jobs. Many of them had already left the legislature. You created jobs specifically for Jean Terrio and Nancy Dahlstrom, and that is hugely problematic. It is a violation of the Constitution.
Just a quick follow-up to that. And why didn't it become an issue then immediately when it happened, Mr. Berkowitz?
I don't know. I know that when I was in the legislature, I'd secured a legal opinion from the Legislative Legal Counsel that specifically stated it is a violation to hire sitting legislators for newly created positions. Okay. And so I'd raise the issue at that point.
Well, when Ethan Berkowitz was in office, Senator Taylor, Senator Osterman, Senator Duncan, these were all legislators who held executive branch positions. Back to John Rader in 1959, this is a practice that attorney generals have approved, said the courts would approve. This Attorney General Dan Sullivan has said, first he gave me instructions on how to do it correctly, and then he said a court could interpret it differently. He didn't say it's unconstitutional. That's not what was said.
Didn't it come down in the end that whether or not there is an existing job or a new job that's just added?
Listen, the value here is that where there's a question, we don't do it. And that's been my promise, that's been my commitment.
But that's not what really happened. There was a question. There's a question in the plain language of the Constitution. You're a trained lawyer. You should have been able to read the Constitution and say that I should not hire somebody who is a sitting legislator for a newly created position, a six-figure position. It looks like you're buying legislators.
No. That's not what the Constitution says, but let's go on.
Okay, Governor Parnell, your opportunity to ask something of Mr. Berkowitz.
Well, sure. When the primary was over, Mr. Berkowitz, you said you embraced Bill Walker and his All Alaska Gas Line plan. Uh-huh. That plan was a public-financed, public-built gas line, government-built, government-financed gas line. Now you say your plan is a private sector gas line. Can you explain specifically how you intend to finance and build the gas line that you're proposing?
Yeah, what I'm gonna do is first I'm gonna have Bill Walker on my team. He's gonna be a critical piece of the team. But in terms of financing the line, there's all kinds of different ways of doing it. When I talk about owning a piece of the pipe, what I'm talking about is giving individual Alaskans, Alaskan businesses, and Alaskan native corporations access to ownership shares in a Great Alaska Pipeline Company. It's been my experience, I've worked on a large fiber optic project where there is a lot of money sitting on the sidelines waiting to finance Alaskan infrastructure projects. If we can go to those financiers with a commitment from Alaskans, a sufficient monetary commitment, we can raise the capital elsewhere. Do not forget that it was just 5 or 6 years ago that MidAmerican Company came up here. It's one of Warren Buffett's companies. They wanted to build an independent pipeline. We just have to create the right kind of conditions to make it happen.
And that Mid-American pipeline was a North American through Canada pipeline that Ethan Berkowitz supported at the time. So what we've heard is that Ethan Berkowitz supported Bill Walker's All Alaska Gas Line, mm-hmm. which was a public-funded $26 billion project from state funds and state financing, but now he's saying it's a private sector gas line. Either he's going to build it with a government checkbook, or he's disavowing Bill Walker and his plan.
Well, I'm embracing Bill Walker, and you might be a little jealous that he's joined my team and not yours. But the truth is that we're going to find a way of financing this plan because it's in Alaska's best interest. The plan that you're pursuing is never going to yield a gas pipeline. We're never going to get jobs from it.
And the plan that I proposed goes to Valdez and goes to North America. If willing buyers and willing sellers are there, as Ethan Berkowitz is saying, they will show up.
Now let's get back to reporter questions. You have 45 seconds to respond, and we'll go to Lori.
Alaska is one of about a dozen states that where all public employees do not participate in Social Security. Should Alaska allow them to participate now that the state has done away with the defined benefits program? Governor Parnell.
You know, I think that's an option worth exploring. I think it would take a supermajority vote of the membership and a financial cost to do it, but I think it's worth exploring at this point.
Yes.
Mr. Berkowitz? Yes. Related to that, the state's current retirement plan does not guarantee retirement income. Municipalities, school districts, and employee organizations across the state believe the state needs to go back to the defined benefits program. Would you support that, Governor?
Well, I've said I would support it if it pencils out. Here's the issue. Every year now, I have to write into the budget a $400 million appropriation because of the hole we dug with the defined benefit before, meaning there's an unfunded liability, billions of dollars that we're writing checks for every year of $400 million. If there's a defined benefit plan out there that will not dig that hole deeper, I'd be for it. And I've indicated, show me the numbers, let's make it work. Because if it can work for Alaskans and not dig us a deeper hole, then we ought to do it.
Mr. Berkowitz?
Well, Sean, you helped dig that hole, because when you were proudly cutting the budget, some of the things you cut were state contributions to the defined benefit system. It made that hole deeper than it needed to be. And we should go back to a defined benefit system because we have an incredibly difficult time recruiting and retaining the best kind of people we can. And we've got a problem now where we're hiring people who, after 5 years of service, leave the state. So we're, in essence, training troopers and training teachers for Washington State, for Oregon, for other parts of the country. We're not doing all we can to keep our people here.
But how would you pay for it?
Well, you pay for a defined benefit system because it's cheaper than a defined contribution system. A defined contribution system over the long haul is far more expensive. The experience of other states in dealing with defined contribution is it leads to enormous downstream costs because people wind up without the health care that they expect to have, and it is just more expensive. And people, the money managers that deal with the pension systems that are part of a defined benefit system outperform on a systemic basis. They outperform individual investors by a significant amount.
Governor, do you agree with that?
I don't. I've had the pension managers as well as our Division of Retirement Benefits. I've had union representatives in my office and asked each one of them, if you can show me how to provide a defined benefit and do it without digging a deeper hole, I'll do it. So far, nobody has been able to show how it pencils out.
Dermot, next question.
Okay, I'd like to go back for a minute, if we can, to Denali Kid Care. That's the program that pays for health care for Alaska's low-income children. Governor Parnell, earlier this year, you vetoed a $3 million expansion to the program because you said that the program pays for what are deemed medically necessary abortions, and that you had not known that was the case before. Guess what I'd like to know is, are you going to propose to eliminate the Denali Kid Care program because it continues, as far as I understand, to pay for medically necessary abortions?
The Supreme Court would not allow that to happen. You could get rid of the Denali Kid Care program and they'd require abortions to be paid from another program. What I did is I had the expansion of the Denali Kid Care program and I had the budget money, and I was able to veto both because I just, from a value perspective, I simply do not believe we should be increasing the number of public-funded abortions. In this case, there are about 2,000 beneficiaries under Denali Kid Care. Kids in these low-income populations need true health care. They need their diabetes cared for, they need bronchitis cared for, but if 2,000 beneficiaries are in that program and 664 of them are receiving abortions, then we've got a problem, and we should not be expanding Denali Kid Care just so that more publicly funded abortions could occur.
You know, I've just met too many parents and too many kids who are the beneficiaries of Denali Kid Care. And When I think of those young people who are sick and hurt and don't have access to health care because Sean cut the addition, that's very cruel. And I think had he been intellectually consistent, he would have vetoed the entirety of Denali KidCare. But to do what he did, it smacked a little bit of political opportunism during a Republican primary season.
I just have a quick follow-up to this. Governor, where do the numbers come from that you're citing for the number of abortions? Reporters have tried to suss that out and
well, the Department of Health and Social Services provided those reports to reporters. It's over 600 abortions, publicly funded abortions, every year for at least the last 5 years from Denali KidCare.
And those medically numbers, necessary. Medically necessary.
No. A significant number of those are miscarriages and are classified under Health and Social Services statistics as abortions, but they're miscarriages, and there's a huge distinction.
That's also not true, but those records are available from the Department of Health and Social Services.
Well, let's move on to something completely different. What will rural communities in Alaska do if the federal subsidy for bypass mail system ends? Mm-hmm. Mr. Berkowitz.
It's going to wreak incredible havoc, and I thankfully, we're not in the Senate race, and so I don't have to question whether bypass mail is constitutional. But I think what we need to do is do what's been done in years past, is we need to start growing more product and more produce in the communities. There's a fellow in Bethel right now who grows about 10 acres of root vegetables. They're good root vegetables. They taste great. But we can do that all around the state. And we can do that if we have low-cost energy. We can go back to the way things once were, where there are greenhouses and potato patches in communities. But we've got to start taking care of ourselves more, and we cannot count on the federal government.
Governor.
Well, bypass mail is incredibly important, but we all know that federal funding is drying up. So when it comes time to work a solution, the governor is going to be right in there. I'm going to be right in there advocating for federal funds for bypass mail. But at the same time, you're right. We do have to become more independent as a people. So when the federal government tries to tie its national education standards to funding and say that you will accept the funding only if you accept national standards and don't let your local school districts independently make their own standards, I said no. So it's going to take those tough stands at the right time, but it's also going to take advocacy on behalf of rural Alaska for things like bypass mail.
Dermot?
A listener in Ketchikan suggests that, asks this question. Would you support a change for youth detention that includes perhaps a tour of duty in a developing country? This listener says this might be a better way to spend tax dollars, and it might be eye-opening for the young offender. Governor.
You know, I have not even thought about that kind of a solution, but I think those opportunities exist here for work and service for young offenders. We have villages in this state that are as underdeveloped as anywhere in the world, and so yes, you know, let's put more into service projects as well.
Mr. Berkowitz.
We have the second highest rate of incarceration for youthful offenders in the country, and we clearly have to do something different. And if sending young Alaskans abroad to get a taste of what life is like when conditions are truly difficult helps the rehabilitation, I'm all for it.
Thank you.
Lori?
A listener wants to know if the administration should push the federal government to provide land for the landless communities, Native communities in Southeast Alaska. Mr. Berkowitz.
Could you repeat that question?
The landless Native communities that mm-hmm. got left out of the land selections process. Mm-hmm. Okay. Should there be a push to see that they get some land?
Absolutely. I think the land selection is part of the Native Claims Settlement Act, and we need to make sure that the communities that didn't have access to land selection ultimately do have access to land selection. It's a simple question of equity and justice.
Governor?
Yeah, to the extent they were not afforded that opportunity earlier, I certainly would support that.
You touched on this a little bit earlier in the program when we talked about ways to help families in need and also some of the families in crisis in both urban and rural Alaska. But one of our listeners, John Palms of Juneau, wrote specifically asking about how to help people who are trapped in the cycle of alcohol abuse in the short term. We've heard some about your platform, but how can you help people over the next couple of years as they try to heal themselves and their families, Governor?
You know, we spend $54 million a year on prevention programs, most of it alcohol and substance abuse, and still we have a huge issue here. It's going to take not only government funding, but it's going to take us as people choosing healthier lifestyles and being personally intervening with friends in that situation. I have a grandfather who was an alcoholic and died an alcoholic. My father made different choices, and it's they're intensely personal, but it's going to take more than just more funding for alcohol and substance abuse. It's going to take personal responsibility as well.
Mr. Berkowitz?
It is going to take more than simple funding, but we don't do what we can for the people who have this disease. And what we can do and what we haven't do is have more beds available in treatment centers. We can have more treatment centers across the state, treatment centers that are more culturally relevant. Some of them will be publicly supported, or at least partially publicly supported. Some of them will be privately supported. But we need to make it easier for treatment to be available. 80% of crime in the state is drug or alcohol related, and people who are caught in this vicious cycle, having worked with this community, not all of them are going to get out of it, but many of them will if you stay and are persistent and give them an avenue of escape.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. We are out of time. So with that, we will conclude the 2010 Public Broadcasting Debate for the State for Alaska's Governor. Our thanks to the candidates and also our panelists this evening, Dermot Cole of the Fairbanks Daily News Miner, and Lori Townsend and Dave Donaldson of APRN. Tuesday, November 2nd is Election Day. Alaska's polls will be open from 7 o'clock in the morning to 8 o'clock at night. Please remember to vote. Thank you for watching, and good night.
After tonight's debate, sponsored by AARP, visit aarp.org/yourvote to find out where the candidates stand. Because it's your right, your decision, your vote. Paid for by AARP. Go to aarp.org/yourvote today to find out where the candidates stand. And be sure to vote on November 2nd.